American Free Press Audio Edition 19 and 20, May 6th and 13th, 2019. Globalist Lilo Has Europe Become Too Hot for Elite Bilderberg Meeting? By Mark Anderson. Europe has become too inhospitable for Bilderberg, at least for the time being, according to Tony Gosling, a former colleague of AFP Bilderberg hound Jim Tucker, who worked with Tucker for several years exposing Bilderberg. Gosling, an investigative journalist from Bristol, UK, points out that Eurosceptics, who opposed the Eurozone and the European Union itself, the very creation of which was nurtured by Bilderberg, said that candidates and politicians who want the national sovereignty of their nations restored are making headway, getting into political office. This includes Germany. As a result, news of a Bilderberg meeting in Europe at a time of such strong anti-globalist sentiment and developments could prove damaging for the group, especially in terms of bringing back unwanted, widespread publicity about the secretive gathering, something the group has labored to control and reduce as much as possible in its more than six decades of existence. They could cause a lot of trouble for themselves meeting in Europe, Gosling said. As Bilderberg prepares for its 67th meeting in 65 years, they could end up on a lot of front pages, which they don't want. That kind of publicity was seen last year when Italian populist politicos in the Five Star Movement and other parties made noise against Bilderberg's meeting in Turin, Italy. While the coverage was not deafening, to Bilderberg, a transnational planning and networking outfit that brings together the best, the brightest, and the wealthiest from carefully selected fields in the public and private sectors, any sustained or meaningful coverage that doesn't dismiss Bilderberg's opponents is darkly frowned upon. The UK's Daily Mail newspaper did manage to briefly infiltrate the 2018 Bilderberg meeting in Italy. While the infiltration was limited and the resulting article was not up to AFP's or Gosling's standards, the development was another pushback against Bilderberg's secrecy in Europe. The cradle of his birth in 1954 via Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands and obscure European movement organizer Joseph Ertinger, CIA money helped fund the first Bilderberg meeting in the Netherlands at the Hotel de Bilderberg, hence the group's name. Since Europe may prove too hot for Bilderberg for now, and Bilderberg met too recently, 2017, in the US to return to the States, where might they meet this year? The strong belief is Canada will host the next gathering. The Bilderbergers last met there in 2006 at the Brook Street Hotel in the national capital of Ottawa. A return there appeared possible at press time, since Bilderberg rather frequently returns to past venues. The group has met at the Westfields Marriott in Chantilly, VA, several times, including in 2008, 2012, and 2017. Another August hotel in Ottawa where the group could conceivably meet is the Hotel Fairmont Chateau Laurier, where even the cheapest rooms book for more than $600 per night. "It's always a guessing game," said Gosling, who warmly remembers working with Tucker, something this writer did three times in 2010 through 2012. "The group always puts out a lot of bumsters to mislead the Bilderberg watchers," author Daniel Estrulin, another longtime Bilderberg watcher who in 2017 released a movie about Bilderberg, told AFP that even he did not know where the group will meet in 2019, indicating perhaps that the Bilderbergers are trying to put the proverbial publicity genie back in the bottle and avoid hostile environments whenever possible. "Yes, America, there really is a border emergency. Is there a crisis, a national emergency, on the U.S. border with Mexico? Many Democrats and far-left activists, who want to throw open the country's border, say, no, more reasonable people disagree. So what's the truth? Is the country really facing an invasion from the South, or are demagogues just inflaming American fear to harvest votes?" In this week's edition, we look in depth at the issue, going so far as to have our roving editor Mark Anderson visit the border in southern Texas and report for us on location. While touring the Rio Grande Valley, Mark had the opportunity to sit in on a press conference given by acting Rio Grande Valley Sector Border Patrol Chief Hector Escamilla. And how did this top border official characterize the situation? "No surprise there, it's a crisis," Escamilla elaborated on this, noting that, in the past 6 months, His agency have apprehended nearly 200,000 illegal immigrants in his sector alone, which consists of 300 miles of river, more than 300 coastal miles, and more than 30 counties, and they were not just Mexicans or Central Americans, he added, they were pouring in from Asia and the Middle East in pretty large numbers as well. Escamilla's comments to us mirror what we have been seeing at a national level, U.S. Customs and Border Protection, CBP, the federal agency responsible for policing America's borders, announced that, in March alone, the Border Patrol detained over 103,000 immigrants trying to illegally cross the border, the most for 1 month in over a decade, Homeland Security Secretary Kevin McAleenan told a congressional hearing, on April 28, in classic Trump fashion, the president, in an interview with Fox News, didn't euphemize the situation, telling the news host, "It's like Disneyland now. Before, you would get separated, and some people would say let's not go up. Now, you don't get separated, and, while that sounds nice and all, what happens is you have 10 times as many people coming up because they know they're not going to be separated from their children." So it turned out to be a disincentive, which is obviously a disaster, he added, it's a system that Congress can fix, but, they don't get off there, expletive deleted, the Democrats could solve it so quickly because we're going to have all the infrastructure soon, by the end of the next year most of the wall is going to be up, Trump concluded his interview by saying that, if Congress fixed the laws, the crisis would be over. Border security is apprehending 100,000 people a month, he said. We should be able to kick them right out. We can't. We have to bring them into a court. Whoever heard of that? How bad are things on the border? 2 days before American Free Press went to press, CBP announced that its agents had captured the largest group of immigrants to ever illegally cross into the United States. On April 30, CBP tweeted, Border Patrol agents apprehended the largest group of 424 illegal aliens just after midnight this morning in Sunland Park, NMA. Second group of 230 illegal aliens was also apprehended in Antelope Wells, NM this morning, in the Rio Grande Valley area, which our editor tweeted, CBP characterized the number of illegal aliens they caught as unprecedented, on average, Border Patrol agents in the Rio Grande Valley arrest more than 100 people per day, CBP reported in a press release on April 23. Meanwhile, the mainstream media continues to poo-poo the situation. On April 8, PBS, which is funded in part by U.S. taxpayers, reported, a closer look at the numbers raises questions on whether these issues, drugs, terrorism, and illegal immigration, are getting worse, and whether they constitute a crisis. Earlier this year, The Washington Post fact-checked Trump's call for dealing with the crisis on the border, claiming that there's no data to back up the president's claim. Those few media outlets that do concede that there is a humanitarian crisis only do so because they want to blame it all on Trump, forgetting that the chief executive is only tasked with enforcing the laws. It is Congress that is responsible for passing them. The evidence is there. The country is facing a crisis on our border. And while immigration is a benefit for the country, the unchecked, massive, illegal wave that's battering the nation does no one any favors, not average Americans and certainly not the immigrants themselves, who risk their lives to illegally come to the United States. Christopher J. Petherick, Executive Editor, Deep State Conditions Public for War News Flash, it's America, not Russia, that is the real danger to world peace. By Paul Craig Roberts. The Russian Embassy in Washington has prepared an accurate 121-page report, The Russiagate Hysteria, a case of severe Russophobia. Everyone should read this report. It documents the fake news, lies, violations of diplomatic standards and international law, and gratuitous aggressive actions taken against Russia during the period beginning May 18, 2016 and continuing through the issuance of the Mueller report. Without explicitly saying so, the report shows that neither the U.S. government nor the American media has a nanoparticle of integrity. Both are criminal organizations that are willing to risk war with Russia in their pursuit of narrow politicized agendas. This is important information for Americans and the rest of the world to have. Every person, every government, and every private organization that supports Washington's Russophobic policies is contributing to the growing threat of nuclear war. One hopes also that the entirety of the Russian government, media, and population also read the report, as it has equally powerful messages for Russia. The messages are no doubt unintended, but they nevertheless emerge from the embassy's report. The Russian government should marvel at its naivete in trusting Washington, U.S. institutions such as Citibank, and U.S. adherence to international law. For 121 pages the report lists transgression against Russia followed by transgression and lie followed by lie, yet the Russian government continues to send diplomatic notes that are never answered, requests for meetings that are never answered, requests for evidence that are never answered. One would think that month after month of abuse would have caused the Russian government to wonder, where was the intelligence, cooperative spirit, reason, and common interest in global security that Russia's responses to Washington assumed were present in Russia's partner? The Russian government's naive and gullible response to Washington played into Washington's hands, by responding to Washington's orchestrated Russophobia as if it were some kind of mistake based on bad information. The Russian government allowed Washington to keep the process of demonization alive and thereby contributed to the ongoing demonization of Russia. If, instead, the Russian government had denounced the demonization of Russia as Washington's act of preparing Americans for war with Russia and had taken a belligerent rather than a complaining stance, the realization that Washington's policy had serious costs would have spread throughout the U.S. and Europe, and voices would have arisen against Washington's dangerous and reckless policy. Today, in place of the uniformity of voice against Russia, there would be dissent opposing Washington's irresponsible provocations. The danger of Russian self-delusion is not over. The embassy's report expresses the hope that now that Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation of President Donald Trump and his campaign has concluded that the much-heralded collusion has no basis in fact, relations between Washington and Russia can be normalized and cooperation achieved. There is no such possibility. The Democrats are screaming cover-up and demanding the resignation of Attorney General Barr and Trump's impeachment. The prostitutes are claiming that the Mueller report vindicates their reporting. In addition, Trump continues to use U.S. foreign policy to commit criminal acts. He has declared that the president of Venezuela is the person he picked, not the one Venezuelans elected. He has given to Israel part of Syria as if Syrian territory is his to give. He threatens Iran with war as Israel requires. In other words, American arrogance rises to ever higher heights. At some point the Russian government and Russian people are going to have to accept the fact that to reach an understanding with Washington, Russia must either surrender her sovereignty or become as belligerent as Washington and replace Russia's useless refutations of Washington's accusations with accusations of her own. Otherwise, Washington is going to keep pushing until war is the only possible outcome. Gutsy Attorney brings us up to date on unique lawsuit against SPLC by Glenn Allen. These are dark times for freedom-loving people all across the Western world. This is especially true if their values tend toward national unity, suspicion of intrusive government, and revulsion toward fake news and media orchestrated smear campaigns. When the night is dark, we must navigate by the stars. Each of you who has donated to my lawsuit against the Southern Poverty Law Center, SPLC, is a star. I am sincerely grateful for your support. My lawsuit has proceeded very much as I anticipated. I was certain the SPLC would file a motion to dismiss all my claims, and that is what it has done. I was prepared for it, and have opposed it vigorously. The briefing on that motion is now complete and we await the court's decision. If the motion to dismiss is denied even in part, my case will proceed to discovery, that is, document requests and depositions, which should be extremely interesting given the recent scandals at the SPLC. If the motion is granted, I will appeal to the Fourth Circuit. Either way, I will need your continued financial support to stay in the ring against the SPLC, which has become such a blight on freedom in our country. Please stay with me in this fight by contributing to the Free Expression Foundation, FEF, which is dedicated to helping persons such as myself and many other persons in similar situations. FEF is a tax-exempt 501(c)(3) nonprofit organization. and thus your donation is tax deductible to the greatest extent of the law. Please know that I am in this contest not only for myself but to vindicate fundamental principles of free expression that must protect us all, and not merely this generation but future generations. Let's not lose sight of the ancient truth that while the fight to preserve freedom is hard, the fight to regain freedom once it has been lost is even harder. Again, I thank you and ask for your continued financial support. Please use the form on the back page, 32, of this issue of American Free Press. Many legal experts tell me I have what they think is the best chance to win of any suit that has been filed against the SPLC thus far. I sure hope so. They tried their best to ruin me, and I am just returning the favor. See page 32 to help FEF defeat the SPLC. Impeachment only way to beat Trump, Democrats, fake news media, GOP insiders collude on impeachment strategy. By Donald Jeffries. The report by special counsel Robert Mueller concluded that there is no evidence that Donald Trump colluded with Russian figures to rig the 2016 presidential election. This hasn't even slightly deterred those who want him impeached. The New York Times, flagship newspaper of the deep state, ran an April 25 story headlined, "The Danger in Not Impeaching Trump," written by veteran establishment Odie Elizabeth Drew. It advised Congress that despite being politically risky, it has a responsibility to act. Never has the mainstream media called for the impeachment of a president so openly. Last month, The Atlantic proclaimed, "Impeach Donald Trump." CBS News is all in on this effort, having run a recent in-depth analysis of what it would take to get an impeachment. Even seemingly friendly Fox News is asking, "Is Trump trying to get impeached?" Democratic presidential nominee Senator Elizabeth Warren, Mass., tweeted, after the release of the Mueller report, that the House should initiate impeachment proceedings against the President of the United States. Fellow senator and presidential contender, Kamala Harris, CALF, advocates impeachment as well. Former Trump transition team member J.W. Verrett and establishment Republican William Weld also believe Trump should be impeached. Democratic Party leaders like Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, CALF, are more cautious, almost certainly aware of the fact that a recent poll from Trump-friendly Politico found that only 34% of Americans support impeaching Trump. Trump, confident as always, maintains that he is not even a little bit worried about the prospect of impeachment. Those who want Trump impeached are remarkably vague about exactly what he's done that warrants it. Some have floated out the notion that while Trump didn't commit any tangible obstruction of justice, he is nevertheless guilty of impeachable obstruction, whatever that is. Trump's most vociferous opponents seem to simply want him to go away, and they aren't very particular about how this might be accomplished. Much as they hate him primarily because of his volatile personality, they irrationally believe he should be impeached because they find him offensive, hateful, a racist, etc. In 1998, President Bill Clinton became only the second chief executive in the history of the United States to be impeached by the House of Representatives. He was impeached on two charges, perjury and obstruction of justice, relating to his illicit affair with young White House intern Monica Lewinsky. The establishment press had a remarkably different perspective on Clinton's impeachment, consistently portraying it as a partisan Republican sideshow. In fact, they even refused to televise the live proceedings from the impeachment trial in the Senate, an incredibly rare and historical event. Unlike Richard Nixon, who resigned before he could be impeached, Clinton has been treated with near reverence since completing his two terms in office. While any potential impeachment charges against Trump are nebulous at best, in the recent past other presidents have committed far more tangible, potentially impeachable offenses. Former populist Rep. Dennis Kucinich, D. Ohio, strongly advocated impeaching Presidents George W. Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney for the weapons of mass destruction lie that led to the pointless and disastrous Iraq War. Kucinich leveled 35 charges in all against Bush and Cheney, including the capture and treatment of prisoners of war, domestic spying and wiretapping, and even questions about 9/11. There were persistent threats of impeachment against Barack Obama, with no less than the Washington Post headlining a 2014 article, How President Obama will be impeached. Most of these efforts, which were spearheaded by groups like Lyndon LaRouche's Political Action Committee, revolved around the questionable circumstances of Obama's birth and the Benghazi scandal. Compared to the identity politics-driven campaign to impeach Trump, the cases against both Bush and Obama certainly seem to have had far more validity. While Nixon is still regularly equated with using the powers of his office to target political opponents, the reality is quite different. The mainstream media and court historians still trot out Nixon's anemic enemies list, while ignoring Obama's far more lengthy kill list of his opponents. As writer Monica Crowley said, "Article I of the Articles of Impeachment against Richard Nixon was just the simple fact that he talked about and suggested the potential use of the IRS against one or two political opponents. In reality, presidents starting with Franklin D. Roosevelt have routinely used the IRS to target their political opposition. Democrats have subpoenaed the full Mueller report, thinking it will somehow bolster their impeachment campaign, apparently unaware of the conclusions of the Mueller report. Wildly overhyped young Rep. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, DNY, tweeted in response to it, "Mueller's report is clear in pointing to Congress's responsibility in investigating obstruction of justice by the president, considering the perpetual corruption within our executive branch. It would be laughable to impeach Trump over so many other worthy contenders. How Obama colluded with Ukraine to help Hillary beat Donald Trump. By Donald Jeffries. While a two-year investigation into President Donald Trump's alleged ties to Russian officials has produced no evidence of any collusion, the mainstream media continues to ignore troubling connections between the Obama administration and foreign governments. The most recent example involves former Obama White House counsel Greg Craig and how he allegedly misled the U.S. Justice Department about his law firm's work in Ukraine. Craig is charged with providing false and misleading information to the Foreign Agent Registration Act office regarding the trial of Yulia Tymoshenko, a political rival of the country's then-president, Viktor Yanukovych. Former Trump campaign head Paul Manafort was seemingly held to a different standard under the same act during Robert Mueller's investigation. A recent story in The Hill described how the Obama White House attempted to use Ukraine to give an early boost to the whole Russian collusion narrative. A January 2016 meeting in the Oval Office between some of the top Ukrainian prosecutors and investigators and representatives of the National Security Council, FBI, State Department, and Department of Justice has been documented by contemporary memos and testimony of multiple participants. Ukrainians who were at the meeting have stated that it quickly became apparent the meeting's purported agenda of training and cooperation was a front. Instead, U.S. officials were clearly interested in two hot political controversies. One of these involved Vice President Joe Biden's son Hunter's affiliation with Ukrainian energy company Burisma Holdings. Bank records revealed that more than $3 million went from the Ukraine to an American firm tied to Hunter Biden during 2014 to 2015. U.S. officials asked the Ukrainians if they would drop the Burisma probe and turn it over to the FBI. The Ukrainians refused, but Biden went on to pressure Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko to fire the country's chief prosecutor in March 2016. This resulted in the Burisma case being transferred and eventually shut down, according to Andriy Telesenko, a political official in the Ukrainian embassy in Washington, who organized the meeting. U.S. officials kept talking about how important it was that all of our anti-corruption efforts be united. The Americans stated that they had no interest in reviving a 2014 investigation into then-GOP lobbyist Manafort and others in the U.S. receiving payments from Ukraine's Russia-backed Party of Regions. At that time, the FBI had questioned Manafort about any improper foreign lobbying but stopped the investigation without charging him. Telesenko was unable to recall if Manafort's name was mentioned at the meeting. But other Ukrainian attendees remembered that Department of Justice representatives had asked investigators from Ukraine's National Anti-Corruption Bureau about finding new evidence regarding the Party of Regions payments and associations with Americans. It was definitely the case that led to the charges against Manafort and the leak to U.S. media during the 2016 election, Telesenko declared. Spokespersons in the Department of Justice, National Security Council, and FBI declined to comment on the Hill's article, and a representative for former Obama National Security Advisor Susan Rice did not return their emails. Nazar Kolodnitsky, Ukraine's chief anti-corruption prosecutor, told The Hill that he attended some of the January 2016 meetings in Washington. He described seeing a ledger showing payments from the Party of Regents to Manafort and said that Ukrainian authorities had known about it since 2014. Commenting on the sudden release of this evidence by the U.S. Friendly National Anti-Corruption Bureau, NABU, in May 2016, right after Manafort was named Trump's campaign chairman, Kolodnitsky declared, "Somebody kept this black ledger secret for 2 years and then showed it to the public and the U.S. media. It was extremely suspicious. I ordered the detectives to give nothing to the mass media considering this case. Instead, they had broken my order and published themselves these one or two pages of this black ledger regarding Paul Manafort. For me, it was the first call that something was going wrong and that there is some external influence in this case," Kostya Antonkulik, deputy head of the Ukraine Prosecutor General's International Affairs Office, corroborated this, noting, "Yes, there was a lot of talking about needing help and then the ledger just appeared in public." Kulik also said that Ukrainian authorities had evidence that others, like former Obama White House counsel Gregory Craig, had also received money from Yanukovych's party, but the Americans weren't interested in any of that. They just discussed Manafort. This was all and only what they wanted. Nobody else, Kulik said. A Ukrainian court concluded, in December 2018, that NABU's release of the ledger was an illegal attempt to influence the U.S. election. A member of Ukraine's parliament even released a recording of a NABU official commenting that the agency released the ledger to help Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. In an April 25 appearance on Fox News, President Donald Trump chimed in, "It sounds like big stuff. It sounds very interesting with Ukraine. I'm not surprised. Hillary's missing emails found in Obama Oval Office," says FBI. By Donald Jeffries' Judicial Watch was reported the bombshell information that an FBI official has admitted under oath that the agency found Hillary Clinton's notorious emails in the executive office of the then-president, Barack Obama. In court-ordered discovery, the same senior FBI official, Assistant Director of the FBI Counterintelligence Division Bill Priestap, also said that the agency had reviewed nearly 49,000 emails from Clinton's server as a result of the search warrant for her material on the laptop belonging to former Rep. Anthony Weiner, DNY. At the time, Weiner was married to Clinton's top aide, Huma Abedin. U.S. District Court Judge Royce Lamberth ordered senior State Department officials, lawyers in the Obama administration, aides to Clinton, and Priestap to be deposed or answer written questions under oath. In approving the discovery plan submitted by Judicial Watch, the court referred to the Clinton email system as one of the gravest modern offenses to government transparency. Priestap had testified in a separate lawsuit that Clinton was the subject of a grand jury investigation related to her BlackBerry email accounts. This astonishing confirmation, made under oath by the FBI, shows that the Obama FBI had to go to President Obama's White House office to find emails that Hillary Clinton tried to destroy or hide from the American people. Judicial Watch President Tom Fitton stated, "No wonder Hillary Clinton has thus far skated. Barack Obama is implicated in her email scheme." Judicial Watch's discovery is specifically seeking answers to whether Clinton intentionally attempted to evade the Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, by using a non-government email system, whether the State Department's efforts to settle this case beginning in late 2014 amounted to bad faith, and whether the State Department adequately searched for records responsive to Judicial Watch's FOIA request. In an April 25 interview with Newsmax TV, Fitton accused the Department of Justice of conducting a sham investigation to protect Clinton and Obama and target Trump. On this same day, Fitton leveled that identical accusation in an appearance on Lou Dobbs Tonight on the Fox Business Network. Fitton has also suggested that President Donald Trump should file a criminal complaint with the Department of Justice over being illicitly targeted. Earlier this year, Judicial Watch examined 186 pages of Justice Department records, which included emails documenting a cover-up of potential violations of law by Clinton when she was Secretary of State. Judicial Watch obtained the records under a January 2018 FOIA lawsuit, which was filed after the Justice Department failed to respond to their initial December 2017 FOIA request. The watchdog group is also attempting to obtain all communications between former FBI official Peter Strzok and his ex-lover, FBI attorney Lisa Page. A July 8, 2016 email chain reveals that just 3 days after then-FBI Director James Comey's press conference, in which he announced that he would not be recommending prosecution of Clinton, the special counsel to the FBI's executive assistant director of the National Security Branch, whose name is redacted, wrote to Strzok and others that he was producing a chart of the statutory violations considered during the investigation of Clinton's server, and the reasons for the recommendation not to prosecute. This individual further stated, "I am still working on an additional page for these talking points that consist of a chart of the statutory violations considered during the investigation, and the reasons for the recommendation not to prosecute." Hopefully in non-lawyer-friendly terms, it is sobering to compare this secrecy to all that was made of the emails of private citizens like Jerome Carsey and Roger Stone, in a convoluted effort to associate them in some way with Julian Assange, who was just as dubiously tied to Russian officials. Meanwhile, the admitted destruction of servers containing the former Secretary of State's emails has been forgotten. Israel provoking nuclear war between Pakistan and India. By Dave Gallery, Israel may not have much to worry about in regard to retaliation when they lob U.S.-made weaponry on innocent civilians in the open-air concentration camp of Gaza, but the dangerous game they are perilously playing in South Asia has the potential of sparking an atomic war between that region's nuclear-armed adversaries, India and Pakistan. As reported February 28 in the UK's Independent under the title Israel is playing a big role in India's escalating conflict with Pakistan, Robert Fisk explains why it is that the little, nettlesome, bellicose state's actions are pushing us all toward Armageddon. At the heart of the matter is money. India, Israel's largest weapons market in 2017, paid $700 million for Israeli air defense, radar systems, and ammunition, including air-to-ground missiles, most of them tested during Israel's military offensives against Palestinians and targets in Syria. This information makes clear the reason Israel slaughters humans like penned lambs. It is to test their weapons and improve their chances for a sale. Israel, a country of 9 million, 75% Jewish, 21% Arab, 4% other, is ranked number 10 in the world's top 10 largest arms exporters, behind the US, Russia, China, France, Germany, the UK, Spain, Italy, and Ukraine, no doubt helped along by the billions US taxpayers are forced to fork over to the non-ally every year. This fact no doubt confounds the world's thinking class, who are aware that the Jewish state comes in at 25 out of 174 countries ranked by median and mean wealth per adult. With that as a backdrop, this latest imbroglio was kicked off by what's being referred to as the 2019 India-Pakistan standoff. A Pakistan-based terror group conducted a suicide bombing of an Indian military convoy, slaughtering more than 40 soldiers. 2 weeks later, on February 26, a dozen Indian fighter jets bombed the terrorist camp in the Pakistan-controlled area of Kashmir, eventually leading to the downing of an Indian jet and the capture of its pilot, who has since been returned. Tensions remain high, however, with India threatening to fire at least 6 missiles into Pakistan and Pakistan promising its own missile strikes 3 times over. Only via concerted efforts by DC, Beijing, and London have the threats been ratcheted down. Significantly, this is the first such clash in Kashmir since the last war there in 1971. Kashmir, the main cause of all major conflicts between the two countries, was hotly contested even before India and Pakistan won their independence from Britain in 1947. Kashmir was free to choose between India or Pakistan, and the local rulers' choice of India led to a 2-year war. The fact that some Indian-administered states and Kashmir are more than 60% Muslim ensures Kashmir will remain a disputed area. It has already led to the two countries going to war three times as well as experiencing several conflicts and military standoffs. Although violence in Kashmir has vacillated for 30 years, the death of a 22-year-old militant leader in 2016 sparked massive protests across the region. Following the funeral, attended by thousands, clashes with troops kicked off a week-long cycle of violence that resulted in the deaths of more than 30 civilians and many more injuries. The result has been a steady rise in violence in Kashmir, which saw over 500 civilians, security forces, and militants killed in 2018, the highest such toll in a decade. To promote its war machines, Israel has been supporting India's government in its battle against so-called Islamists, selling them the Israeli government-owned Rafael Advanced Defense Systems Limited SPICE, smart, precise impact, cost-effective, 2000, used to blow the limbs off of countless unarmed Palestinian men, women, and children to enhance its marketability, which turns 2,000-pound warheads into smart bombs by using the global positioning system, most recently utilized in the Tit-for-Tat Indian terrorist bombing. Israel also conducts joint exercises with India in the Negev Desert, imparting to their guests all the skills they acquired in Gaza and other civilian-thronged battlefronts. So cozy have they become that a 45-strong Indian military delegation was stationed at several Israeli air bases. Given its long history of displaying utter disregard for human lives, from the Levant affair to the USS Liberty to 9/11, Israel stoking tensions in South Asia should keep us all awake at night. Trump risks war over Iran oil embargo. Israeli petroleum gambit imperils Trump's election chances, invites war. By Dr. Kevin Barrett. Has the White House gone insane? On April 21, the Washington Post reported that the Trump administration is ending its waivers exempting Iran's biggest oil customers from Israeli-instigated U.S. sanctions. Over a year ago, the Trump administration, demonstrating its subservience to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, announced it would drive Iran's oil exports to zero. That was supposed to have happened by the end of the first week of November 2018. But shortly before the most biting sanctions ever imposed were scheduled to come online, Trump exempted Iran's leading oil customers. The list of nations that buy Iranian oil begins with China, India, and Korea, which together purchase almost half of the total output. Next are Turkey, Italy, and Japan. All six nations were exempted. Why did Trump tear up his own sanctions last November? Because none of Iran's customers were going to respect them. As Bloomberg reported on August 2, China, by far Iran's largest oil recipient, rejected Trump's request to forego Iranian crude. Tehran's second biggest oil customer is India. In early October, 1 month before Iran's oil trade was supposed to be driven to zero, India said it would ignore U.S. sanctions. In July, even before China and India rebuffed Trump, Turkey had led the way in rejecting the Israeli-American plan to sanction Iran. Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlüt Çavuşoğlu called the planned sanctions inappropriate, and was seconded by President Recep Erdogan, who made it clear that Turkey would continue purchasing Iranian oil. Trump's November 2018 decision to back off from the sanctions was wise. His April 2019 decision to reverse himself and try to enforce the unenforceable was a monumental blunder. Will China, Iran's biggest oil customer, obey Trump? Hardly. We think that China can't and won't back down this time, and we could easily see an increase of Chinese oil imports from Iran up towards maybe 1 million barrels per day, said Bjorn Schieldrop, chief commodities analyst at SEB Group. There will also be an increasing amount of oil exports out of Iran which will go under the sanctions radar. It will drive Iran closer to China and enable China to settle yet more oil in renminbi. As China and other countries thumb their noses at the U.S., it is American prestige and credibility, not Iranian oil exports, that will be driven to zero. And as the world finds ways to trade outside of U.S. dollars, the U.S. dollar will be driven, if not to zero, at least toward a valuation closer to that of toilet paper than gold. But even though everyone expects near universal non-compliance with the sanctions, Oil prices are soaring. Why is that? If Iran will keep selling its oil, maybe even in larger amounts, shouldn't oil prices remain stable or decline? The answer is that sanctions, no matter how toothless, signal hostility, increase the odds of trade wars or even shooting wars, and spook the futures markets. If there is even a 20% probability of a huge trade war, and a 5% probability of a major U.S. attack on Iran, which Iran would respond to by shutting down the Persian Gulf, the oil futures markets turn bullish as high rollers gamble on the long shot possibility that oil prices might shoot through the roof. Once it becomes clear that nobody is respecting the sanctions and American consumers find themselves paying higher energy prices in a stagnating economy, Trump will face a tough choice: either back off once again, thereby shredding what little credibility the U.S. may still have, or double down by enforcing the sanctions, thereby eliciting a tit-for-tat response from China, India, and Iran's other customers. That's a recipe for an all-out trade war that would cripple economies around the globe just in time to ruin Trump's re-election chances in 2020. The real architect of U.S. anti-Iran sanctions is Netanyahu, though. The Israeli Prime Minister is gambling that Trump will be forced into a corner and will have no choice but to start a shooting war with Iran, a war that would likely be set off by yet another Israeli false flag. Such a war would be disastrous for the U.S. like the Iraq War. It would help destroy the Middle East in service to Israeli expansionism, while sapping America's blood, treasure, and prestige. Trump probably doesn't understand how he is being played. He has so much to think about that he doesn't have time to analyze such issues in depth. Instead, he relies on advice from his financial backers, casino magnate Sheldon Adelson, the Kushner family, and the rest of the Kosher Nostra, and their hired guns, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and National Security Advisor John Bolton. By listening to people who hope to benefit from another disastrous Middle Eastern war, Trump is dooming his own presidency and leading his country toward the abyss. Retired Texas cop gives AFP first-hand tour of the border, by Mark Anderson. Brownsville, Texas. A retired Texas policeman recently took American Free Press on a guided tour of a key border crossing where, every day, he sees firsthand America's border dilemma, something he has witnessed unfolding for decades. "The border is actually a two-way street," Rusty Monsees told AFP during an April 24 visit to his 21-acre homestead. "The criminal elements enter the U.S. to do their stuff but return to Mexico when the heat gets too hot and go back and forth several times as needed, and when the law gets too close down there, they come back to the United States." A Border Patrol agent once caught a guy with six different IDs. "This is not a football game where everybody shakes hands at the end. This is dangerous stuff," the former San Benito, Texas cop pointed out. That some of his acreage is actually south of the approximately 20-year-old border fence that runs past his house, which, oddly enough, is a good 100 yards north of the actual U.S.-Mexico boundary, the winding, murky Rio Grande River. He then started his Ford F-150 truck and led this rider through a gap in the border fence down to the river in order to show up close what he and the Border Patrol he assists deal with on a regular basis. He keeps a rifle handy for self-defense at all times. Asked about border differences since Donald Trump became president, Monsees said there are Mexican citizens who want a safer country and improved border security. Their attitude in the age of Trump has changed. They seem to have more resolve, especially in not wanting their own criminal elements crossing the border and vacationing in the States, as Monsees put it, so those elements can reorganize and head back to Mexico to continue their illicit activities. "What needs to happen," said Monsees, "is a two-fence solution. So, let me get this straight. If I'm a cartel member or MS-13 gang member, I should first be encountering a fence before I even get to the Rio Grande River? A fence on the Mexican side?" this rider asked Monsees. "Yes, that's right," he said, pointing to the river that is lined with a dense thicket of trees, especially on the Mexican side. "This," he added, "provides endless places for border jumpers to hide." Monsees contends that both the U.S. and Mexico should have an interest in border security. As a result, a truly effective fencing scheme would include non-rustable, sturdy, tall metal fencing laced with concertina wire and built on both sides of the river in key areas, with less reliance on the existing gap-ridden tactical infrastructure fencing, as the U.S. government calls it, which is rusting and too often can be climbed or otherwise circumvented by the more determined among the illegal aliens. Monsees pointed out another thing often overlooked, which is a border breach of a different sort. Mercury, lead, diazinon, and trace uranium get into the Rio Grande River via the discharges from the maquiladoras, the large factories with reportedly bad working conditions and poor wages built under the soon-to-be replaced North American Free Trade Agreement. A.C. Ross, the border. This writer then visited Matamoros, just across the border in Mexico from Brownsville, where there was a small tent community that included three Cubans who hoped to enter the United States, a young man named Pablo, accompanied by a pregnant woman about 20 years old and another young man, said they were hoping she can give birth in the U.S., evidently for welfare assistance. He claimed they were flown in a plane from Cuba to Brazil, between October and now. They said they reached the Texas border mainly by bus. Border Patrol chief recounts the immigration turmoil, real crisis, by Mark Anderson McCallan, Texas, acting Rio Grande Valley, RGV, Sector Border Patrol Chief Hector Escamilla, speaking at the McAllen Citizens League's luncheon April 25, outlined the daunting task carried out by the Border Patrol to reduce the overall flow of illegal immigrants and focus on the criminal element that steadily enters the U.S. While his assessment of the border crisis and some recommended solutions corroborated important matters American Free Press has reported on, as Camilla added some clarifying points to illustrate the complexity and severity of the crisis. A 30-year Border Patrol veteran, as Camilla explained that the Border Patrol, which has 3,100 agents in the four-county RGV sector, needs to press for specific policy changes that will increase deportations and result in a package deal where the wall, helpful though it may be, is one of several coordinated measures needing to be implemented. Having 3,100 agents may sound impressive and adequate, but by the time sick leave, vacations, and administrative desk duties are covered, only half of those 3,100 officers end up being boots on the ground at any given time. For a border sector covering 316 river miles, from the mouth of the Rio Grande all the way to the Falcon Dam, that's a pretty daunting task, as Camilla said. He clarified, a lot of the area we cover is dense brush. The lateral mobility is very difficult because a lot of the land that we patrol is owned by personal landowners. We can't just traverse continuously along the river. In addition, government and private wildlife refuges along the border, heavily regulated in a manner that prevents border agents from mowing the place down to find hidden illegal immigrants, further complicate the issue. What's more, Border Patrol must help guard the coastal counties. We're actually responsible for the entire Gulf shoreline, all the way to the Louisiana border, said Escamilla. So we do have agents in different places along the coastline. He added that, in the RGV sector alone, 165,000 illegal immigrants have been apprehended at the border since the start of the fiscal year, October 1, 2018. During the same period, there has been a 150% increase of OTMs, other than Mexicans, illegally entering the U.S., he explained. The majority of the OTMs are from the Central American countries of El Salvador, Nicaragua, Guatemala, Honduras, pressing Escamilla to confirm that people from more than 40 nations, including overseas, are illegally entering the U.S. This writer interjected, we hear about Asia, the Middle East and even Europe. His response, yes, we've got Middle Eastern folks here, we've got Iraqis, Iranians, a lot of Chinese. Chinese are more common than people might think. Pakistanis and Cubans, we're catching Cubans. These people bring in lots of money for the cartels, $15,000 to $20,000 per person. We estimate that the cartels are making as much or more money from human trafficking than they do from the actual smuggling of narcotics. Asked by another audience member to explain the asylum situation, as Camilla said, the majority of those who come here, they come from economic hardship countries. That's usually what they tell us as the reason they are fleeing. There is in most of those Central American countries a lot of poverty, a lot of gangs, violence, including MS-13 and so on, but the reasons for asylum should be specific to the individual. Did the cartels, did the gangs in their country of origin specifically target them for political reasons, and not so much because there's an economic crisis in the country? Stressing a recommended procedural change, Escamilla remarked, we'd like to see asylum officers actually accessible at the border patrol stations. In fact, there's talk of border patrol agents themselves having the authority to listen to asylum claims, so we can expedite the process. But, of course, that's being met with a lot of resistance. It's going to be met with a lot of lawsuits. Asked by this writer whether the Border Patrol needs another 4,000 agents in addition to the 3,100 in the RGV sector, Escamilla replied that hiring significantly more agents and obtaining the authority to assign more personnel to screen asylum requests are two steps toward developing a solution, along with hiring more immigration judges. We really do need a lot of different factors, and one of them is policy, he said. Until we start returning some of these migrant families and children back to their country of origin quickly to make it more difficult for them to make a second or third trip, then, I don't care how many agents you give us, it's not going to do us any good. There's got to be a change in policy. We've got to communicate with the heads of these countries and ask, why can't you take your people back quicker? Both sides of the border need to be safeguarded. By John Friend, the crisis along the southern border between the United States and Mexico continues to spiral out of control as thousands of migrants attempt to illegally enter the United States on a daily basis, many with entirely fraudulent claims and documentation. According to a recent report published by the Epoch Times, U.S. Border Patrol officials have identified over 3,000 cases in the past 6 months alone that involve fraudulent family unit claims made by migrants seeking asylum or permanent resettlement in America, demonstrating the increasingly difficult situation immigration officials find themselves in when screening migrants and asylum seekers. It's very clear that the cartel and smugglers know the weaknesses in our laws, Acting Homeland Security Secretary Kevin McAleenan said in an April 18 press conference while he was visiting the border near McAllen, Texas. They know that family units and unaccompanied children will be released with no consequences for their illegal entries. McAleenan took over the department following the April 7 resignation of Kirstjen Nielsen, who was often criticized by President Trump. Migrants seeking entry to the U.S. are often screened, processed, and then released into the country, especially if they have children traveling with them. By law, family units must be released upon entry rather than being turned away or detained, allowing illegal aliens, human traffickers, and cartels to exploit U.S. immigration laws. The same child is brought across the border with an adult multiple times to try and gain that release that family units are required under court order, McAleenan stated. According to McAleenan, 4,800 migrants attempted to illegally cross the U.S. border on April 16 alone, underscoring the seriousness of the situation. The 4,800 marked a new record for the modern era, he added. Almost 1,000 of them crossed in just three large groups, 375 people in the largest of those groups. Last month, Border Patrol agents encountered 103,000 individuals along the southwest border, with 92,000 of those individuals being apprehended by agents, marking a 35% increase of apprehensions from the previous month. In the Rio Grande Valley region of Texas, Border Patrol agents have already surpassed the total number of apprehensions during the 2018 fiscal year. Last fiscal year, Border Patrol agents in the Rio Grande Valley, RGV, sector apprehended 162,000 individuals. Supervisory Border Patrol agent Marcelino Medina told reporters in late April, for the first 7 months of this fiscal year, we've already surpassed that number. In the RGV region alone, agents are averaging 1,100 apprehensions every single day. Sydney Hernandez, a local news reporter for KGBT in the RGV region, interviewed a number of migrants seeking entry to the U.S. recently. Many stated that they are being told in their home countries that they will receive help and assistance from the U.S. government if they enter illegally. Immigrants tell me they were coming to the U.S. because they were seeing advertisements on their local newspapers and TV stations about better opportunities and free help from Americans if they enter illegally, Hernandez reported. Illegal aliens are not supposed to receive government benefits, but many do, according to a 2017 study conducted by the Federation for American Immigration Reform, FAIR. Illegal immigrants consume over $100 billion in taxpayer money every year, with countless migrants now entering the U.S. daily. That amount will only increase. We're talking about billions of dollars in taxpayer benefits over the next few years, FAIR Director Dan Stein explained to Fox News recently. The payout for the taxpayer is enormous, and income to the Treasury is minuscule. Overall, illegal immigrants receive more government benefits than they contribute via taxes. Many receive free public schooling, medical care, housing assistance, food stamps, and other social services. Disarmed in related news, two U.S. soldiers who were conducting surveillance along the border, south of the border fence but north of the Rio Grande River, were confronted by Mexican soldiers armed with assault rifles. On April 13, 2019, at approximately 2 p.m. Central Daylight Time, 5 to 6 Mexican military personnel questioned two U.S. Army soldiers who were conducting border support operations in an unmarked Customs and Border Protection vehicle near the southwest border in the vicinity of Clint, Texas, U.S. Northern Command, US NORTHCOM, explained in a statement to CNN. The U.S. soldiers were appropriately in U.S. territory during the incident. The Mexican troops pointed their weapons at the soldiers and disarmed one of them, returning the sidearm to the vehicle. According to US NORTHCOM, an inquiry determined the Mexican troops believed the U.S. soldiers were on the Mexican side of the border. Thus far, President Donald Trump has not commented on this potentially explosive situation. Militia leader arrested. Meanwhile, the FBI has arrested a leader of a militia group in New Mexico whose organization was attempting to stop illegal immigrants from entering the U.S., it was recently reported. Larry Hopkins, 69, was arrested on April 26 on a federal complaint charging him with being a felon in possession of firearms and ammunition. Hopkins's group, the United Constitutional Patriots, UP, has reportedly detained close to 5,600 illegal aliens in recent months in an effort to help Border Patrol agents and immigration officials deal with the increasingly lawless southern border. Hopkins and his group have been denounced and criticized by the governor of New Mexico and other left-wing, open borders activist groups, including the Southern Poverty Law Center and the American Civil Liberties Union. Members of the UCP are convinced Hopkins will be cleared and are proud of their righteous cause. We're not worried about it, stated Jim Benvey, a spokesperson for the group. He's going to be cleared. Brexit supporters ridiculed by globalist fake news media, by St. Patrick with another Brexit deadline extended, moving from April 12 to October 31. British politicians, the European Union, EU, and the global media now have more time to pressure Brits into either staying in the EU, thus cancelling Brexit or re-voting, or brokering a Brexit agreement favourable to the globalist interests that control the EU. One step below predicting the biblical apocalypse, the British and US media have both prophesied the most dire gloom and doom situations imaginable for those still supporting a hard Brexit, leaving the European Union with no entangling agreements or alliances. Within the anti-Brexit press, the terminology has also become more divisive. Those supporting British sovereignty were once innocuously called Brexiters or Brexiteers, that evolved into Leavers, having to paint supporters of the Leave campaign as dangerous enemies of the state. They are now referred to widely as Brextremists, a combination of Brexit and extremist. Surveying hundreds of recent headlines regarding Brexit, the most used descriptions are catastrophe, catastrophic, and disaster. The EU Parliament chief warned of a Brexit catastrophe. Former Prime Minister Tony Blair said a no-deal Brexit would be catastrophic for the UK. The BBC begged UK leaders to extend the deadline to avoid a no-deal Brexit catastrophe. One news analysis site warned that Brexit was not just UK Prime Minister Theresa May's disaster. The Week magazine went as far as to proclaim that the Brexit disaster could destroy the United Kingdom, Brexit supporters are being portrayed as mindless zombies chasing the ideas of jingoistic simpletons. Nobel Prize-winning geneticist Paul Nurr stated that the UK is sleepwalking into Brexit. The term gammon has been hurled at Brexit supporters who, according to the website of London's Daily and Sunday Express, are white, puffy, pink-cheeked, angry, middle-aged Brexit voters. The former spokesperson for Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn defined gammon as an older man who, despite having all the opportunities that baby boomers enjoyed, is confused and angry at the modern world. Few publications supporting the Remain perspective have considered the problems plaguing the UK and forcing its citizens to consider detaching from the European Union. According to exit polling taken at the time of the Brexit vote, 49% of respondents said they cast their ballot to regain sovereignty for the UK. They want decisions affecting Brits to be made in Great Britain, not in Brussels. Many decisions within the EU are made not by mass voting, but by regulatory agencies with appointments determined by unelected leaders within the EU. Even the pretense of democracy no longer exists within the EU's most powerful hierarchies. Exit polling also showed that 33% of UK voters supported Brexit as a means by which to gain control over immigration, to regain the ability to control their own borders. British author Leo McKinstry wrote, "The metropolitan elite likes to claim that mass immigration is an engine of social progress, bringing vibrancy to our culture and prosperity to our economy. In reality, the vast annual foreign influx achieves the opposite, profoundly reactionary in its consequences. This demographic revolution has weakened solidarity, worsened living standards, and intensified pressure on our public services. As cohesion frays, our once gentle, well-ordered society is awash with violent crime and poisonous identity politics." Many Brits have also favored Brexit because the EU, they claim, is a system set up for global elites. British journalist Paul Mason wrote that the EU provides the most hospitable ecosystem in the developed world for anti-monopoly corporations, tax-dodging elites, and organized crime. The global recession of 2008 convinced many Brexit supporters that over-reliance on the euro as a currency can produce difficult results. They point to Greece and Spain, both of whom suffered severe economic crises after the global recession and both of whom still suffer unemployment rates over 20%. While the UK decided not to join the common currency, it has still found itself economically responsible for the downfalls of other euro-backed economies within the EU. Currently, the UK sends approximately $19 billion to the EU on an annual basis. That averages out to $300 per person that is spent on EU programs rather than British ones. The unbreakable globalist tie that has kept the EU together may now be broken by the United Kingdom. The great irony is that, 243 years after 1776, it is now Great Britain that is attempting to break the bonds of economic slavery, foreign hierarchies, and globalist agendas in order to form a more perfect union. Picking candidates via victim points: why intersectionality is so important to the brainwashed left-leaning voter. By St. Patrick. Trying to decipher what makes a Democratic nominee for president viable enough has become as difficult as correctly keeping the official scorebook for a slugfest in baseball. The intra-party debate over Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg has not centered on Buttigieg's lack of political experience, being bereft of legislative accomplishments, or the near impossibility of making a jump from the mayor's office to the Oval Office. After all, that leap was something even America's Mayor Rudy Giuliani couldn't do after 9/11 catapulted him to political superstardom. Buttigieg's challenge within his own party is a little-known yet perplexing labeling philosophy called intersectionality. Intersectionality is the idea that the sum of a candidate's diversity factors adds a maximum value to an ideal candidate, one a New Democrat can support. Therefore, a Hispanic male, one diversity factor, being Hispanic, isn't as valuable or viable a candidate as a Black female, two diversity factors, being Black and female. A Black, gay, disabled female would have a theoretical score of 4. The Daily Caller Celine Ryan calls them victim points. If this seems as politically manic as it does logically ridiculous, that's because it is. Intersectionality is full of holes, Even when argued vociferously by those who adhere to it most, high political positions have often been battles of the moneyed class, but Americans, in their collective hearts, still believe that voting should be a meritocracy. The positions should be earned by demonstrating a history of successful experiences. Intersectionality devalues a candidate's literal experiences and instead judges a candidate by demographic factors. Though being a mayor of a Midwestern American college town such as South Bend, home to the University of Notre Dame, hardly seems the typical path to the presidency for a Democrat, Buttigieg is attractive to the Democratic Party as an openly homosexual candidate. The problem for some left-wing pundits is that he also has a high WASP Y factor. He is a white male who also openly professes a devotion to his Christian faith. In a discussion at this year's South by Southwest Festival in Austin, Texas, Buttigieg admitted that he has also felt the white male privilege. He recalled a time when he was caught with marijuana and not arrested. The lack of arrest is something he attributes directly to his gender and his race working in harmony to produce a lack of prosecution. Questions arise the moment the informal scoring process begins. How will the Democratic Party weigh each factor? Does a candidate's gender weigh more or less than their race? Does a candidate's race weigh more or less than their sexuality? Are all demographic factors equal? In an opposite the editorial page for The Atlantic, Lucas Grindley dismissed many of Buttigieg's personal accomplishments, such as speaking 8 languages, some of which could be politically valuable. Grindley cares about one factor, but as a gay man, I'd care that Buttigieg is gay, Grindley wrote. Grindley believes that it is demographic factors that will determine a politician's ability to solve problems. Not having some ability to work with a friendly, divided, or hostile legislature, these facets of their identities mean that they can understand the powerless, as victims of power, and that they can understand the alienated, having been marginalized, Grindley wrote. Therefore, for Grindley, Buttigieg's sexuality is as important or more important than Senator Cory Booker's race, the gender of Rep. Tulsi Gabbard, the confused heritage of Senator Elizabeth Warren, or the religion of Rep. Ilhan Omar, if she were to ever seek higher office. Why? Because that's what he personally values and because it's the factor with which he most identifies. It's a mindset not uncommon among millennials. Right, good, and valuable are determined by whatever they choose to be or believe, not by what may benefit a majority of the Americans most. The most rabid defenders of intersectionality within the Democratic Party do poll younger. If it seems like Buttigieg's views on public policy have not had a proper airing, they haven't, and they may not get one. Even when debate season begins, expect the Democratic candidates to focus largely on their own niche, their intersectional wins. If this is the case, the door is wide open for Republican candidates to win a battle of ideas. That battle will be the high road, whereas the low road, being dragged into a fight over cultural norms, will only allow Democrats to reinforce tired stereotypes about out-of-touch Republicans. Republicans should let Democrats argue over which candidate is a better recycler, or which candidate is nicer to geese, or whether a candidate empathizes enough with a self-professed victim of human nature. Intersectionality will survive because its fringe supporters care about or know little else. But with an aging American tax base watching those same debates, expect intersectional winners to also be exposed as corporate, pro-war Democratic emperors in new clothes. Meddling violates Monroe Doctrine. American imperialism on vivid and hypocritical display in South America, by S.T. Patrick. As a global presence gathers in and around Venezuela in the wake of the U.S. supported coup, National Security Advisor John Bolton has clenched tightly to Teddy Roosevelt's metaphor, Ike Big Stick, and is warning foreign nations to remember that the U.S. government is entitled to defend the backyard it has extended southward since the Monroe Doctrine first became informal policy in 1823. In January, the U.S. government outwardly supported opposition leader Juan Guaido over Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. It was another in a long history of foreign coups supported by the U.S. military-industrial complex. All this occurred while American politicos debated whether or not Russian Facebookers bought ads that could have influenced American voters in 2016. What prompted the recent hardline comments of Bolton was the introduction of Russian, Chinese, and Iranian planes into Venezuela. President Trump is determined not to see Venezuela fall under the sway of foreign powers, Bolton told radio host Hugh Hewitt. Apparently, to neoconservatives like Bolton, the only foreign power allowed to sway the Venezuelan government is the United States. In making his argument, Bolton emphasized the importance of the Monroe Doctrine, as well as President Ronald Reagan's anti-communist crusades in Central and South America throughout the 1980s. The Monroe Doctrine was first outlined by President James Monroe in 1823 during his seventh State of the Union address. Monroe stated that any effort made by a European power to take control of an independent state in South America would be the manifestation of an unfriendly disposition toward the United States. In turn and in fairness, Monroe also stated that the United States would then not meddle in the affairs of European countries. It was still a globalist, anti-democratic policy that split up the world into spheres of influence controlled, undisturbed, by the major global powers. The newly created CIA used the Monroe Doctrine to foment coups after World War II. President John F. Kennedy used it to protect Americans from a growing Soviet missile presence in Cuba. President Reagan invaded Grenada in 1983 and illegally supported the Contras over the Sandinistas in Nicaragua throughout the 1980s. When America was acted aggressively in the Western Hemisphere throughout the 20th and 21st centuries, it has pointed to the Monroe Doctrine as justification. Bolton continued, if the Monroe Doctrine fails, if China and Russia, along with Cuba, establish domination over Venezuela, I think American strategic interests will be harmed. Further bolstering his belief in the Monroe Doctrine, Bolton said, we strongly caution actors external to the Western Hemisphere against deploying military assets to Venezuela, or elsewhere in the hemisphere, with the intent of establishing or expanding military operations. We will consider such provocative actions as a direct threat to international peace and security in the region. The problem international observers have recognized is that of hypocrisy regarding the doctrine's application. In February, the U.S. Navy deployed two guided missile destroyers to challenge Chinese ships within 12 nautical miles of Chinese outposts in the South China Sea. The U.S. government called it a freedom of navigation operation. China's foreign ministry spokesman said the U.S. entered Chinese waters without permission and engaged in provocations that threaten China's sovereignty. President Donald Trump has, throughout his presidency, also made inroads with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, progress made largely without consulting the Chinese leadership. Though China borders North Korea, certainly, North Korea is within China's direct sphere of influence. The U.S. has also stationed tanks, airplanes, and heavy weaponry within NATO-aligned states that border Russia, certainly within Russia's sphere of influence. When challenged by Russian officials, the Pentagon claimed it was innocently deciding where to store a battalion's worth of military equipment in Europe. The positioning in proximity to Russia was mere coincidence. More directly, Syria and Iraq are in the Middle East. Afghanistan is in Asia. Libya is in North Africa. Bosnia is in Southeastern Europe. All are well beyond the U.S. sphere of influence as argued by the directives of the Monroe Doctrine, yet all have seen the heavy presence of U.S. troops in recent decades. If the entire world is now a local stage for every nation's national interests, then it is problematic to assert the Monroe Doctrine in the Western Hemisphere, in a country 2,800 miles away from U.S. borders. If the Pentagon is going to continue to justify placing weapons and troops outside the borders of China, Russia, and Iran, then it is understandable that Russia, China, and Iran would see their own interests at stake in the oil-rich country of Venezuela. The difficulty in accepting U.S. foreign policy as an argument is that Americans are taught and then told that the only goals of foreign policy are U.S. interest, human rights, and furthering democracy. Yet, when arguments for intervention are made, they must also apply to the foreign policy and economic goals of other nations, as well. Trump's Yemen blunder. By Richard Walker. President Donald Trump's decision to veto a congressional measure designed to pull America out of the Saudi-led war in Yemen, which has killed tens of thousands of women and children, is a striking example of the unchecked war powers Congress has given precedence since the early 1970s. In a rare bipartisan effort to end U.S. support for the Saudi-led war, Congress sent the president the resolution, expecting he would reject it, which he did. He justified his decision by claiming it threatened to weaken his constitutional authority. He thereby ended the matter because Congress lacked the two-thirds majority in the House and Senate to override his veto. The reason there is not a bigger congressional majority to confront the Yemen issue, and with it the president's seemingly unchecked power to wage war without congressional approval, is that there are many members of Congress on both sides who are influenced by Israel's support for the Saudis, and just as many who are beholden to Saudi political donations. No country spends more money on lobbying in Washington and on Capitol Hill than Saudi Arabia and its coalition partner in the war, the United Arab Emirates, UAE. Also in play is the Trump family business connection to the Saudis, who have spent heavily in buying Trump properties over decades, and the close personal relationship between the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and the young, impetuous Saudi leader, Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS. Kushner, MBS, and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu share a similar view of Middle East politics. They see the war in Yemen as a way of dragging Iran into a wider conflict since it supports the Houthis of Yemen. It is worth noting that when the war began in 2015, there were 10 Arab nations involved, including Egypt and Jordan, but as of today that figure has been reduced to 4, the Saudis, UAE, Sudan, and Bahrain. The reason for nations peeling off was international outrage and the unchecked slaughter of Yemeni civilians. In just a few years, there have been 24,000 airstrikes and, aside from the massive death toll from those, tens of thousands have died from disease and starvation, the majority of them children and the elderly. The war has been made possible by the Saudi and UAE use of weapons provided by the US, France, and Britain. Democrats critical of Trump's support for the war ignore the fact that his predecessor, Barack Obama, supplied the Saudis and the UAE with more weapons than his predecessor, George W. Bush, in Kings and Presidents, a book on the history of U.S.-Saudi relations. Former CIA officer Bruce Rydell writes that no president since Franklin Roosevelt courted Saudi Arabia as zealously as did Obama. Not only did Obama authorize more arms sales than any other U.S. president, he visited Saudi Arabia more frequently than any of his predecessors. Trump's veto override of Congress's resolution coincided with the public leaking of French intelligence documents that exposed how the Saudis could not manage the war without French, U.S., and British weapons, as well as the constant supply of spare parts. The leaked papers highlighted the lies French leaders had been telling their own people about the war. President Emmanuel Macron had insisted that French weapons were being used by the Saudis and their allies for purely defensive purposes. It was an outright lie. French weapons were used in the slaughter of civilians. For example, the powerful French Caesar howitzer capable of launching shells deep into Yemen had been within range of 430,000 civilians. It was revealed that the Saudis had placed an order for another 126 Caesars to be delivered before 2023. The leaked intel also confirmed that French arms companies had provided the Saudis and the UAE with their most powerful tanks, helicopters, and missiles. The French government was so embarrassed by the report that it immediately ordered an investigation to find the person who leaked it to a French journalism site. Amnesty International was one of many organizations that responded to the leak by calling on France and other Western nations to be more transparent and to halt sales of arms that were being used in war crimes. The French have not been alone in supplying some of the most advanced deadly weapons that have caused untold civilian casualties in Yemen. The leaked papers also pointed out that most of the planes flying over Yemen were NATO types such as F-15s, EU Tornado fighters, and British Typhoons. The majority of helicopters were Apache and Black Hawks, and many Saudi battle tanks were American Abrams. As AFP has pointed out in previous articles about this war, the deadliest munitions used by the Saudis were acquired from U.S. companies and the Pentagon. An incontrovertible fact is that French, American, and British arms companies have benefited tremendously from supplying the Saudis and their partners with an unlimited supply of weapons that have been used to slaughter innocent women and children. This candidate wants to put workers first. Presidential contender argues universal income would improve American lives. By John Friend, Los Angeles, Calif. There are currently 22 individuals running for President of the United States in 2020 as Democrats, with some more likely contenders than others. Perhaps the most interesting candidate of the bunch is Andrew Yang, a 44-year-old father, entrepreneur, former tech executive, and founder of Venture for America, a nonprofit organization that seeks to train young professionals and recent college graduates to work for startup companies in major cities around America. Since announcing his 2020 candidacy, Yang has sparked the interest of a wide variety of the American political electorate, uniting people with diverse demographic and political backgrounds. Interestingly, many segments of the dissident right have rallied around Yang, a seemingly unlikely candidate for those espousing conservative, nationalistic political perspectives. Yang is currently traveling the country campaigning, organizing speeches and rallies, and participating in community discussions as part of his Humanity First tour. This reporter attended his rally on the evening of April 22 that took place in Pershing Square in the heart of Los Angeles. According to official campaign estimates, at least 2,000 enthusiastic supporters of Yang showed up, ranging from young high school students to retired professionals. Yang supporters, commonly known as the Yang Gang, come from an extremely diverse ethnic and political background, which was reflected in the crowd at Pershing Square. Former Trump-supporting conservatives, former supporters of Bernie Sanders and other more mainstream Democratic candidates, environmentalists, and labor activists, among others, were in attendance. The common theme uniting such a diverse demographic and political coterie is reflected in Yang's campaign slogan, "Humanity First." As Yang makes clear in virtually all of his speeches, rallies, and debates, his goal is to put humans first by helping the average American worker and family, who have been negatively impacted by economic globalization, outsourcing, and automation, a signature campaign issue. During his speech in Los Angeles, Yang elaborated on the threat that automation and robotics poses to average American workers. Countless workers right in downtown Los Angeles, a once thriving jewel of the West Coast that is now home to one of the nation's largest homeless populations, have been laid off, had their hours cut, or have seen their job opportunities disappear due to automation and robotics. A major theme of his campaign, Yang has commendably pushed the challenges posed to American workers by automation, robotics, and outsourcing into mainstream political discourse. Yet another of Yang's signature campaign issues is the idea of universal basic income, which he proposes should be $1,000 for every American adult over the age of 18. This basic income guarantee would help offset the challenges average workers, students, and families face in an increasingly globalized, automated, and digitalized economy. He also proposes a universal medical insurance system administered by the government to guarantee all Americans are afforded basic medical coverage. In his speech in LA and in countless interviews and debates he has participated in, Yang has persuasively argued that healthcare and medical insurance have become a financial burden on average American workers and families. These basic income and medical insurance policies are part of his broader idea of human-centered capitalism, which is the bedrock of Yang's political and economic philosophy. Human-centered capitalism, according to Yang, represents a new form of capitalism that is geared toward maximizing human well-being and fulfillment. On his official 2020 campaign website, Yang outlines the three basic tenets of human-centered capitalism. Humans are more important than money. The unit of a human capitalism economy is each person, not each dollar, and markets exist to serve our common goals and values. Yang genuinely wants to make the economy work for the average person, and advocates measuring the health and productivity of the economy in ways that actually matter to average workers and families rather than corporations, hedge fund managers, and bankers. He often argues that gross domestic product, GDP, a common measurement of the American economy regularly cited by President Donald Trump, is obsolete and irrelevant to most average American workers. GDP does not measure an economy's well-being or how average workers and families are faring, which is central to Yang's economic and political paradigm. Hispanic conservative targeted megabank pulls account of man associated with America First activist group, by John Friend Enrique Terrio, the national chairman of the Proud Boys and operator of an online store selling patriotic and politically incorrect merchandise, had his account shut down by Chase Bank, one of the largest financial institutions in the world today. This writer recently had the opportunity to speak with Terrio about, among other things, how the financial sector has been turned into a weapon by liberal activists, who want to stymie free speech and thought in America. Terrio, who heads the Miami chapter of the Proud Boys and also serves as the group's national chairman after Gavin McGinnis stepped down and disassociated himself with the controversial group late last year, had his bank account unexpectedly closed last month. In an official letter from Chase Bank, Terrio was informed that the bank can no longer support your banking account, S, and will be closing it on April 1, 2019. The letter from Chase abruptly announcing his account would be closed came just days after Terrio was deplatformed by Chase's online payment processor known as Chase Payment Tech, which Terrio had been using on his online merchandise website 1776 Shop to process financial transactions. Terrio, like many conservative activists and organizations, has been deplatformed by virtually all social media outlets as well as online payment processors. In addition to Chase Bank and its online payment processor, Terrio and the Proud Boys have been shut down by PayPal, Stripe, Square, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Terrio and the Proud Boys have been highly demonized and slandered by the fake news media in recent years, which portray the group as a violent and bigoted gang of white supremacists and racists. Ironically, the group consists of members from various ethnic and racial backgrounds, and merely considers itself a pro-Western fraternal organization. Terrio recently explained to this reporter that the Proud Boys operate independent chapters in many major American cities, and that the group is basically a men's drinking club that enjoys discussing politics. Regardless, mainstream media outlets continue to characterize the group as holding white supremacist, racist views. "My political views pretty much mirror those of President Donald Trump," Terrio explained recently to Big League Politics, a conservative alienating online news outlet that originally broke the story about his Chase account being shut down. But the media, and groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center, smear me trying to tie me, an Afro-Cuban, to ideologies that would force me out of my own country if they went into effect. "It's completely asinine and based completely outside of reality." James O'Keefe, the founder of Project Veritas, conducted an investigation into Chase's decision to shut down Terrio's account, which included recording conversations with Chase employees who were asked to explain why the account was closed. Terrio spoke with Chase officials before the account was officially shut down, and none could provide an explanation why his account was being terminated. "I see nothing that indicates any reason why the account should be closed. I don't see any outstanding transactions or anything ridiculous," one Chase employee told Terrio during a recorded conversation. O'Keefe's group later called and recorded a conversation with Chase Corporate Global Media Relations, where an employee explicitly stated that the bank is not involved with any alt-right people, revealing that the bank may actually target customers with conservative or right-wing political views. Following the release of O'Keefe's report and video documenting this conversation, Chase Bank Communications Officer Patricia Wexler contacted O'Keefe to offer an explanation. "We do not close accounts due to political affiliation," Wexler told O'Keefe. Despite what was described in the video, that was not someone from Global Corporate Media Relations. "As I'm sure you can appreciate, I'm not able to share any personal details on anyone's individual or business account." Despite Wexler's so-called clarification, many suspect that Terrio was specifically targeted by Chase precisely to his conservative political views and involvement with the Proud Boys. Terrio spoke to this reporter last weekend to offer more insight into the situation. I was never given a legitimate reason for my account being closed, and that's why I began inquiring, Terrio explained. After the Big League Politics story broke, Chase was more responsive but still did not provide a valid reason. When we did the expose with Project Veritas was when I finally got the reason. They claimed I gave them the incorrect URL for my website. That was a blatant lie. My website had to pass a certification, meaning they had to go to the URL given to perform it. Terrio described what's happening in America as corporate fascism, as more and more conservatives and others with politically incorrect perspectives continue to be censored and shut down by major corporations and social media outlets. Jack Dorsey, the CEO and founder of Twitter, admitted recently to online commentator Joe Rogan that his company does have a left-leaning bias and that he was going to work on addressing this issue. Terrio noted, "This is evolving at a speed that the American people cannot catch up with." Terrio hopes the increasing levels of tyranny and corporate censorship inspire more Americans to speak out on these injustices. Get off the couch, call your congressman, become active, Terrio told this reporter, to support conservatives who have been deplatformed in one way or another. Go to 1776 shop. Diversity we have, unity we don't. Democrats and Republicans locked in 21st century political civil war. By Patrick J. Buchanan. President Donald Trump has decided to cease cooperating with what he sees, not incorrectly, as a beltway conspiracy that is out to destroy him. "We're fighting all the subpoenas," Trump said recently. "These aren't, like, impartial people. The Democrats are out to win in 2020. Thus the Treasury Department just breezed by a deadline from the House Ways and Means Committee to deliver Trump's tax returns. Thus the White House will invoke executive privilege to deny the House Judiciary Committee access to ex-White House counsel Don McGahn, who spent 30 hours being interrogated by Robert Mueller's team. Thus the Justice Department is withholding from the Oversight Committee subpoenaed documents dealing with the decision to include a question on the 2020 census about citizenship status. Across the Capitol, the barricades are going up figuratively as they did physically in the 1960s and 1970s. Once more, it's us against them. Cognizant of the new reality, Trump seems to be saying, these House investigations constitute a massive political assault, in collusion with a hostile media, to destroy my presidency. We do not intend to cooperate in our own destruction. We are not going to play our assigned role in this scripted farce. We will resist their subpoenas all the way to November 2020. Let the people then decide the fate and future of the Trump presidency, and that of Nancy Pelosi's House. In response to Trump's resort to massive resistance, Rep. Gerald Conley, Diva, said, "A respect for the limits of your branch of government, a respect for the role of other branches of government, is sort of the oil that makes the machinery work. Absent that, this breaks down. And I think we're definitely seeing that." Conley is not wrong, but the requisite mutual respect between the Democratic House and the Republican White House simply does not exist. It broke down a long time ago. The campaign of 2020 is on, and the stakes are huge. Not only are the first and second branches of government in play, so, too, is the third, the Supreme Court. Many Democrats, refusing to accept the success of the 50-year conservative long march to capture the court, are determined to pack an expanded court with liberal justices to overturn the conservatives' victory. With Republicans having won two presidential elections in 20 years, with fewer popular votes, Democrats are also resolved to rewrite the Constitution and abolish the Electoral College. Not only ex-convicts but felons in prison must now be allowed to vote, says Senator Bernie Sanders, IVT, even if that means the Boston Marathon bomber. Under the Sanders reform, if someone murders you, he is still entitled to an absentee ballot. The right to vote is apparently more sacred than the right to life. Truly, this is the divination of democracy. Trump's defiance of House subpoenas will fire up his base, which sees the world as he does and has never cottoned to what President Gerald Ford cherished as the politics of compromise and consensus. Whatever may be said about the deplorables, they are not obtuse. They do not believe that people who call them racists, sexists, nativists, and bigots are friends and merely colleagues of another party or persuasion. Trump's defiance of subpoenas, however, will force the more moderate Democrats to join the militants in calling for hearings on impeachment in the House Judiciary Committee, which is where we're headed. The media are already salivating over the possible removal of a president they have come to loathe more than their great nemesis of the 20th century, Joe McCarthy and Richard Nixon, and the media will reward those who echo the call for impeachment. This week, two more Democrats running for president, including Senator Kamala Harris, came aboard. Soon, the House will capitulate to the clamor and the stampede will be on. The problem for Democrats attempting to overturn the election of 2016 and remove a president who has the passionate support of a third of the nation will sunder the Democratic Party base as surely as it will unite the Republicans. Should impeachment succeed, a wound would be inflicted on the American body politic that would take years to heal. In the longer run, however, the question being raised today goes to the long-term health of the Republic itself. America surely does not lack for diversity. Its diversity, racial, religious, cultural, ethnic, ideological, political, is visible and ever-growing. What is missing is the concomitant of unity. Moreover, it is the more racially, culturally, religiously, ethnically, and ideologically diverse of the parties, the Democrats, that seems the more splintered than a Republican Party that is supposed to be afflicted with the incurable and fatal disease of Trumpism. The questions raised by the present state of our politics, which might fairly be described as an American civil war without arms, are these: how does a nation so divided stand united in the world, and if it cannot stand united in the world, how long does it remain a great nation? A disgusting truth about America, shocker: an estimated 100,000 children are bought and sold in the U.S. every year by John W. Whitehead. Young girls, some as young as 9 years old, are being bought and sold for sex in America. The average age for a young woman being sold for sex is now 13 years old. This is America's dirty little secret: sex trafficking, especially when it comes to the buying and selling of young girls, has become big business in America, the fastest growing business in organized crime and the second most lucrative commodity traded illegally after drugs and guns. As investigative journalist Amy Fine Collins notes, it's become more lucrative and much safer to sell malleable teens than drugs or guns. A pound of heroin or an AK-47 can be retailed once, but a young girl can be sold 10 to 15 times a day, and a righteous pimp confiscates 100% of her earnings. Who buys a child for sex? Otherwise ordinary men from all walks of life. They could be your co-worker, doctor, pastor or spouse, writes journalist Tim Swerens, who spent more than a year investigating the sex trade in America. In Georgia alone, it is estimated that 7,200 men, half of them in their 30s, seek to purchase sex with adolescent girls each month, averaging roughly 300 a day. It is estimated that at least 100,000 children, girls and boys, are bought and sold for sex in the U.S. every year, with as many as 300,000 children in danger of being trafficked each year. Some of these children are forcefully abducted, others are runaways, and still others are sold into the system by relatives and acquaintances. This is not a problem found only in big cities. It's happening everywhere, right under our noses, in suburbs, cities, and towns across the nation. As Ernie Allen, former president of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, points out, the only way not to find this in any American city is simply not to look for it. Every year, the girls being bought and sold get younger and younger, too. The average age of those being trafficked is 13. Yet, as the head of a group that combats trafficking pointed out, let's think about what average means. That means there are children younger than 13. That means 8, 9, 10-year-olds. Where did this appetite for young girls come from? Look around you. Young girls have been sexualized for years now in music videos, on billboards, in television ads, and in clothing stores. Marketers have created a demand for young flesh and a ready supply of over-sexualized children. All it takes is one look at social media photos of teens to see examples. If they aren't imitating porn they've actually seen, They're imitating the porn-inspired images and poses they've absorbed elsewhere, writes Jessica Bennett for Newsweek. Latex, corsets, and stripper heels, once the fashion of porn stars, have made their way into middle and high school. This is what Bennett refers to as the pornification of a generation. In other words, the culture is grooming these young people to be preyed upon by sexual predators, and then we wonder why our young women are being preyed on, trafficked, and abused. Social media makes it all too easy. As one news center reported, finding girls is easy for pimps. They look on Facebook and other social networks. They and their assistants cruise malls, high schools, and middle schools. They pick them up at bus stops, on the trolley. Girl-to-girl recruitment sometimes happens. Foster homes and youth shelters have also become prime targets for traffickers. Rarely do these girls enter into prostitution voluntarily. Many start out as runaways or throwaways, only to be snatched up by pimps or larger sex rings. Others, persuaded to meet up with a stranger after interacting online through one of the many social networking sites, find themselves quickly initiated into their new lives as sex slaves. Debbie, a straight-A student who belonged to a close-knit Air Force family living in Phoenix, Arizona, is an example of this trading of flesh. Debbie was 15 when she was snatched from her driveway by a friend, forced into a car. Debbie was bound and taken to an unknown location, held at gunpoint and raped by multiple men. She was then crammed into a small dog kennel and forced to eat dog biscuits. Debbie's captors advertised her services on Craigslist. Men who responded were often married with children, and the money that Debbie earned for sex was given to her kidnappers. The gang raping continued. After searching the apartment where Debbie was held captive, police finally found Debbie stuffed in a drawer under a bed. Her harrowing ordeal lasted for 40 days. While Debbie was fortunate enough to be rescued, others are not so lucky. According to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, nearly 800,000 children go missing every year, or roughly 2,185 children a day. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents at the Cybercrime Center in Fairfax, VA, report that when it comes to sex, the appetites of many Americans have now changed. What was once considered abnormal is now the norm. These agents are tracking a clear spike in the demand for hardcore pornography on the internet. As one agent noted, "We've become desensitized by the soft stuff. Now we need a harder and harder hit." As journalist David Mixwin recounts in a chilling piece for the Sarasota Herald Tribune, in Oakland Park, an industrial Fort Lauderdale suburb, federal agents in 2011 encountered a brothel operated by a married couple. Inside the Boom Boom Room, as it was known, customers paid a fee and were given a condom and a timer and left alone with one of the brothel's 8 teenagers, children as young as 13. A 16-year-old foster child testified that he acted as security, while a 17-year-old girl told a federal judge she was forced to have sex with as many as 20 men a night. One particular sex trafficking ring catered specifically to migrant workers employed seasonally on farms throughout the southeastern states, especially the Carolinas and Georgia. Although it's a flourishing business in every state in the country, traffickers transport the women from farm to farm, where migrant workers would line up outside shacks, as many as 30 at a time, to have sex with them before they were transported to yet another farm where the process would begin all over again. So what can you do? Educate yourselves and your children about this growing menace in our communities. Stop feeding the monster. Sex trafficking is part of a larger continuum in America that runs the gamut from homelessness, poverty, and self-esteem issues to sexualized television. The glorification of a pimp and hoe culture, what is often referred to as the pornification of America, and a billion-dollar sex industry built on the back of pornography, music, and entertainment. Call on your city councils, elected officials, and police departments to make the battle against sex trafficking a top priority, more so even than the so-called war on terror and drugs and the militarization of law enforcement that so many women and children continue to be victimized, brutalized, and treated like human cargo is to add to three things. 1. A consumer demand that is increasingly lucrative for everyone involved, except the victims. 2. a level of corruption so invasive on both a local and international scale that there is little hope of working through established channels for change, and 3, an eerie silence from individuals who fail to speak out against such atrocities, an urgent appeal from attorney Glenn Allen, by Glenn Allen and Chu, you need to stop asking so many questions, snarled my 10th grade teacher in the Colorado town where I was then living. He was tall, thin, bespectacled, vexed, and pointing his bony index finger at me. He was clearly having a bad day, and so he stomped around the classroom berating the students, definitely including me, that he found particularly troublesome. But he wasn't the first, or the last, to complain that I asked too many questions, and he was right. In a way, I do ask too many questions. For some people, the Southern Poverty Law Center, for example, I'm writing you, a potential supporter of the New Free Expression Foundation, Incorporated 501(c)(3) nonprofit, because I have reason to believe you too have an inquiring mind even on controversial, sacred, cow topics, and that you respect others who make similar probes, even if you may not agree with their views. Let me speak plainly, there are overlapping networks of power in America today, run by savvy, active, unprincipled, ruthless people, that give lip service to our robust First Amendment traditions but whose real aim is to prevent honest debate on controversial topics such as race, diversity, immigration, cultural Bolshevism and many others. Their modus operandi is to destroy those who dissent from the views they approve, and they are highly skilled in crushing anyone who steps outside the narrow lines they draw. I know, I'm one of their victims, one of their many victims. My name is Glenn Allen, CAFP's interview with Glenn in AFP issue 15/16 of 2019, ed. After graduating from college with a degree in philosophy, I served honorably in the U.S. Army and then attended law school, from which I graduated near the top of my class. For the next 27 years I practiced complex litigation for a large law firm, working on cases that sometimes reached all the way to the United States Supreme Court. I worked ethically and diligently and earned an excellent reputation. I devoted many hours to pro bono work helping people who needed help whether they were black, white, Muslim, Jewish or any other. It simply didn't matter to me what race or religion you were. After retiring from the law firm, I went to work for the city of Baltimore, where I threw my heart into helping solve Baltimore's often daunting legal challenges. I felt a quiet but justifiable pride in what I, raised in a broken and often poor family, had accomplished, and looked forward optimistically to the future. All this changed abruptly and profoundly on August 17, 2016, when the Southern Poverty Law Center, SPLC, published a distorted Hatch article about me and made it a news story in dozens of newspapers around the country. Within 2 days I lost my job, my reputation was destroyed, and I became a pariah in the city and legal community I had served honorably. The fact that I had worked zealously and ethically in my law practice and for the city of Baltimore was of no interest to the SPLC. Why would the SPLC care about such things? Its goal was to destroy a political nonconformist as a warning to others and to make money for itself. As it happened, about the time the SPLC attacked me, I had been reading a book that contained a Russian immigrant's account of her life under the old Soviet regime. As I read that account again as the SPLC nightmare was unfolding, I winced. Here is her account. I look at the people who support the transformation of America in disbelief. They are destroying the very land that gave them so much opportunity. In the USSR, representatives of the Communist Party were ingrained into every aspect of civilian, official, and military life. These political organizers controlled public order by observing the behavior and speech of every citizen. People who wanted a more secure and privileged life found it necessary to join the propaganda machine. In order to survive, citizens were silent out of fear of retaliation by the authorities. I winced because I felt I was reading a description of what life was fast becoming here in America under the growing domination of Soviet-style thought control networks such as the SPLC, the liberal media, the entertainment industry, our schools and campuses, and our government. I shook my head in disbelief. Could this really be happening in America? Let's get real, it is happening, with ever-growing intensity. The critical question is, what shall we do about it? To borrow words from Patrick Henry's famous Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death speech, shall we lie supinely on our backs until our enemies have bound us hand and foot, or, if we wish to be free, if we mean to reserve those inestimable privileges for which we have been so long contending, if we mean not basely to abandon the noble struggle in which we have so long been engaged, we must fight. I say we fight back. With your support, the Free Expression Foundation, Incorporated can be an effective means for doing so. Please let FEF hear from you. Let's not lie supinely on our backs but stand tall on our feet, and fight. Please give your most generous donation today.